it gets infected. The way we treat the cut is we put a bandage on it. The bandage is the settlement agreement. It stops the infection from spreading and begins the healing process. The few months that follow a divorce still may be sore, but the hostility usually will subside. It is for this reason that I would like to share some ideas that I learned in my experience of dealing with divorces in the trenches, because that is how we can help our children. Again, it basically comes down to this: get the couple divorced as quickly as possible. Encourage your couples to mediate their cases for the sake of their children. Find members of your community who you believe would be sincere and even-handed facilitators and who would agree to educate themselves on the divorce process in order to help mediate divorces in your communities. These mediators don't have to have a legal background, but they need to be detail-oriented people with a lot of patience. Encourage the husband and wife and their supporters to come to the table with an open mind and in good faith for the sake of their children. Doing what is best for the children is parenthetically best for the couple and will save them time, emotion, and tens of thousands of dollars. Before we discuss the divorce process, we need to touch briefly on why marriage counseling is critical in most divorces. It is imperative that couples and children be placed in proper therapy as early as possible to try to save the marriage. If the marriage is not salvageable and a divorce is unavoidable and the couple doesn't engage in marital therapy together, the divorce will be that much more difficult to accomplish for a number of reasons. First, the spouse who doesn't want to get divorced, often the abuser, will use the lack of marital counseling as an excuse to stall the divorce process. I have dealt many times with cases that were absolute divorce situations due to extreme cases of abuse, but one of the spouses stalled the divorce because the couple never went for therapy together. Second, it is also important because you need therapy on your divorce resume to be taken seriously by the Rabbanim. And third, you never know. It just may work, and sometimes it does, and Shalom Bayis may prevail. Therefore, it is crucial for our Rebbetzins and Rabbanim to have highly experienced therapists to refer for all sorts of situations and dysfunctions. Now it's time for a short course on divorce. Let's call it Divorce 101. The world of divorce is immense. Every divorce is different and comes along with an entire history. But if they end, they usually all end the same. They end with a civil agreement and a get. We will be dealing with how we go from "I want to get divorced" to being divorced. And by the way, any judge in a civil courtroom will lecture the couple before proceeding that in the best interest of the children, all divorce cases must be settled amicably. Unfortunately, too often couples lose focus of the most important priorities, their children. It is also a fact that neither side is ever happy with the settlement, and each side must make sacrifices to protect their children from a bitter divorce battle. In fact, we often joke that when both sides are happy with the agreement, then I know we are close to a final settlement. In order to end a divorce, we need an agreement to be written. That means no matter how the couple came to the threshold of divorce is mostly irrelevant as it relates to the structure of their divorce agreement. We need to understand what goes into the actual divorce agreement. I call it the Big Five. Settle these five issues and we're halfway divorced. Number one is custody. There are two parts to custody. Part one determines which parent is the custodial parent, meaning with which parent the children live. Part two involves which parent makes the decisions relating to education, medical, and general welfare. Number two is visitation. We all know what that means. Most common is alternate weekends, once or twice during the week for the non-custodial parent, and the parties generally will alternate Yom Tovim with the children. Number three is child support. This is a formula that is based on the husband's income, assuming the children live with the wife. Number four, support add-ons. This generally refers to who pays tuition, camp, and health care for the children. Number five is the division of assets. This covers splitting bank accounts, stocks, pensions, marital residence, businesses, and all other property that the couple own together. There is lots to know on each of these topics. However, these are the questions that need to be settled. Settle these and we can write a divorce agreement. The average divorce agreement is approximately 50 to 60 pages long and includes quite a few other issues, such as a radius clause, which restricts the custodial parent from moving outside the visiting parent's travelability, who takes the tax deductions, alimony, and a host of other topics, but they are typically not as difficult to settle as the Big Five. Please note that if either parent may have been involved in any inappropriate behavior, does not impact the terms of a divorce agreement. If chas v'shalom a spouse cheated or gambled or abused drugs or even physically abused the spouse, it has no place in the divorce agreement. Understandably, it is very hard for the other spouse to accept this, and very often this is the crux of the problem. Rebbetzins, we all know that behind every great man is an even greater woman. Now, while there are many rabbanim who are fantastic in helping resolve divorces, there are some who lack experience in this area and are unwilling to involve themselves in their congregants' matrimonial situations. Therefore, Rebbetzins, your role in these divorce cases is even more important than you may understand. It is imperative that rabbanim understand that by helping the parties settle their divorces amicably, they are in a position to ease the pain of divorce for both parties, and most importantly for their children. We must open the lines of communication and not take sides in trying to settle divorce cases. We all need to be on the same page. It's not about taking sides, it's about trying to resolve the Big Five. While we certainly need to sympathize with the husband and wife, we must understand that in order to help that spouse and their children, we must get the divorce done quickly. Even if you believe that one party was wrong, care must be taken to assure that both parties believe you are neutral. The bottom line is that the Big Five need to be resolved. Once we all understand that divorce only comes from finishing an agreement, we must then spend our time encouraging the couple to settle the Big Five so they can all move on. And by the way, four of the Big Five all relate to the care of our children. Everyone getting divorced needs a lawyer, because only a lawyer can write a divorce agreement. The key is which lawyer to hire. This is a big problem, because lawyers have no incentive to settle a case. Often, in fact, they are also stumbling blocks to mediation. Simply put, the more you fight, the more money they make. So if you're a lawyer, why settle a case early for $10,000 when you can keep the fight going and make $100,000? In fact, to my surprise, when we finally came to a resolution in the very first case I mediated several years ago, one of the lawyers said he could not allow his client to take the deal. This shocking statement from the lawyer is not shocking to me at all today, after witnessing the games that some lawyers play in order to keep the money rolling at the financial and emotional expense of their clients and their children. In fact, it shocks me if a divorce lawyer actually accepts a mediated deal of divorce. But don't despair, because we have options, and we also have good lawyers. Thankfully, there are lawyers out there who understand the need to quickly resolve the Big Five and finalize an agreement. Speak to me after if you need to know who is on the list of good lawyers. If the case cannot be mediated by a professional mediator, the next best choice is collaborative law. Collaborative law means that the husband and wife have separate attorneys who try to negotiate an agreement for them. If the lawyers are not successful in settling the case, they're off the case and are not permitted to represent their clients in court. Therefore, the couple must hire new attorneys to represent them in court or Beis Din. This concept of collaborative law gives an incentive to the attorneys to settle the case because they both know that they are off the case if attempts to settle fail. In my opinion, going to court or Beis Din is potentially a nightmare in time, emotion, and money. However, some extreme cases have no choice but to end in these arenas. Many more non-extreme cases also end in these arenas, and that is because we have failed to teach people how to get divorced. To drive home the point of just how important settling divorces without litigation is, I'd like to discuss a few real-life scenarios with you. Even though some of the stories I'm about to tell you would suggest that the husband was the problem, there are just as many cases where the wife is the cause of the divorce. And of course, sometimes both the husband and the wife are the cause. Last week, I was dealing with a case where the husband saddled the wife with millions of dollars of debt that she knew nothing about, among other improprieties that he was involved in. The case went to court, and while playing out in court, I had successfully convinced both parties to agree to a divorce settlement for the sake of the four children. However, the divorce attorney for the wife refused to accept the settlement, saying he could do much better in court. I, on the other hand, with my limited knowledge of law, understood that it was highly unlikely that the lawyer could do as well in court as my mediated agreement for the wife. The wife was afraid not to listen to her attorney and continued in court. Tens of thousands of dollars later, the final ruling came down this past Friday with a deal that was half as good for the wife than the deal I had previously negotiated. Now the husband won't consider the mediated agreement, and the lawyer continues to bill the wife, who, by the way, has no money. This kind of case happens all the time and is particularly sad because the wife's suffering is compounded by and prolonged by poor legal counsel. Couple number two, married for a number of years with three children, the husband is caught cheating and the wife got an order of protection in retaliation to try to get the husband out of the house. The wife, feeling victimized, had unreasonable expectations that she would be compensated in the divorce because of the husband's betrayal. She argued that because of the husband's infidelity, he was an unfit father who should have limited time with their children, and she should get monetary compensation. While the husband's actions are reprehensible, unfortunately, it is not a factor in settling a divorce case, as the courts, and often based in, don't punish the cheater, and they put the mother and father on equal footing. The simple fact is that there is no real compensation to the spouse of a cheater, nor is a parent rendered unfit for infidelity. In this case, luckily, the rabbanim on both sides saw the need to resolve this divorce in a quick and private fashion. The cooperation of both rabbanim was key to resolving this matter without embarrassing the children and without spending a fortune in court. My allotted time is just about up. I have lots more to tell, but the important lesson for us all is that we cannot sit idly by and let people suffer under our leadership. You, our Rebbetzins, must do what you do best and use the wisdom that you all possess to work with these families in pain. You will save the children from the suffering endured from parents who are misguided in the way they too often choose to get divorced today. We must encourage these parents to focus on settling their divorce cases quickly and working on the divorce agreement so the parties and their children can begin to heal. I want to close with the following advice to all of you. Number one, you as Rebbetzins have more power than you think to help facilitate an amicable divorce. Number two, make sure that the divorcing couple understands that many lawyers have a different agenda than they do. Number three, of course you must listen and validate their feelings, but make sure that you encourage them to quickly move on and focus on the main goal, which is the divorce agreement. Number four, don't allow the divorcing couple to compare their settlement agreements to their divorce friends, because not all cases are the same, and they will only highlight some of the points and not the agreement in its totality. Number five, speak to the couple and their parents, but recognize that sometimes the divorcing couple's parents are the impediment to the settlement. I should read that one again. Number six, there are some cases where the woman is left an aguna and the husband refuses to give a get, and you must do everything in your power to prevent this from happening. However, those cases are few and far between. The crisis that we as a community are facing is a more widespread crisis. The divorces are out of control because the divorcing couple both get carried away with their emotions and refuse to engage in fair and honest negotiations. The real victim in those cases are the innocent children, those precious neshamas who have done nothing wrong and who end up being used as pawns by their parents to inflict punishment on their spouse. After hearing my thoughts, one might be quick to say that I'm an advocate for divorce. Nothing could be further from the truth. Rebbetzins, we have had a very serious discussion today about divorce, and we were only talking today of situations where the divorce is absolutely necessary. I have one last thought to share with you. Very often our Rebbetzins double as college teachers and are therefore on the front lines of discerning between cold feet and potentially serious issues that could negatively impact the future marriages of our young college. Therefore, extreme caution must always be taken when we tell our callers, don't worry, it will all work out. When young girls seek your guidance in making the proper decisions prior to a marriage, we cannot underestimate the importance of listening to the concerns of these girls and taking them seriously. Too often, I see the results of those concerns that were swept under the rug. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Thank you for giving me your kind attention. And I feel that today is a very important step towards our community uniting in the desire to put our children's best interests first.
Mr. Ganek, on behalf of the task force and the Rebbetzins, we thank you very much. I know you have told me that you spend hours a day on this issue. So thank you for taking time out of your paying job to come share with us more details about the paying job that you have, which is not necessarily payment that you're going to receive in Olam Hazeh, but in Olam Haba. Admev Esrim. You're helping lots of families. And may Hashem give you the kayach to continue to deal with all the struggles that you see going on in Klal Yisrael. While we're just on the topic of divorce, before we move on, in your folders, there's a beautiful flyer, the next task force event. Be'ezras Hashem will be later on in the week, Wednesday evening, Caught in the Middle, helping children cope with divorce. One of the reasons why we chose Monday as our Rebbetzin's conference this year, we've never done it on a Monday before. We wanted to do it a few days before Caught in the Middle was happening on Wednesday, to let you all know that this was occurring and to encourage you to please attend. Encourage the people in your community who are struggling with this. Encourage the people who need chizuk. And encourage the people who can spread the word to others. Again, Wednesday, Dr. Hindi Klein from Tikva Ed Ohel is the chairperson for that event. Thank you very much. Moving right along. We are on time, by the way, in case anyone's wondering. We are absolutely on time. But so far, everybody has referred to referrals, referrals, referrals. Get good referrals. That's part of what the task force is all about. Again, I just refer you back to your task force folder. Many, many agencies. Many are Brooklyn-based. Let me just talk to my Queens ladies over here. The hat that I wear in FEGS, if you could pass this around. I'm funded by a particular grant in Queens to be able to specify getting particular referrals in Queens and Long Island. Please call, let me know what you need, and let us find you the best therapist that we possibly can. Going back to your task force brochure, the agencies listed and the people up here can provide you with other referrals as well in the rest of the boroughs. Moving right along, it's no coincidence that we started our Rebbetzin's conference with Faye Wilbur 10 years ago. Now we are starting the next decade of Rebbetzin conferences with Faye Wilbur as a highly skilled private practitioner, director and leader of the Borough Park office of the Jewish Board in Borough Park. She is a good personal and professional friend and an outstanding professional, Faye Wilbur.
Hi, thank you again for having me, and thank you for coming. What you do in the community is remarkable. The previous speaker taught me I should be intelligent, I should be succinct, and I should make sure you keep paying attention, because he was so interesting, I was mesmerized. When we plan conferences, there are lots of things that have to be taken into consideration. We did not consider what Parsha was read last Shabbos, so I would like to just refer you all back to that as you think about my presentation about the impact of sexual abuse in the community. The other thing that we couldn't take into consideration was my schedule, so I'm not going to be able to stay until the end. But in the packet is my phone number. I left business cards. Feel free to call me if it's an emergency, say so. Otherwise, I will call you back as soon as I can. I try within 48 hours. And lastly, my task is just to give you an overview. I don't want you to expect yourselves to know everything. I don't want you to think that you're supposed to remember everything. There are some handouts in your packet. We have the New York State packet about abuse. Disregard the fact that Elliot Spitzer, according to that packet, is still the governor. I think there might be some kind of message there, since it's the topic, but we don't talk politics. And in addition to talking about the signs and symptoms of abuse, the other thing I'm only briefly going to touch on is the multiple levels of victims we have when there's sexual abuse, because anyone who calls sexual abuse a victimless crime, you'll excuse me, is a fool. So when we talk about the signs and symptoms, you know, I don't have to spend any time on the physical symptoms, because most of the time there are no physical symptoms. Most of the time, children are asked to do things, asked to see things, are touched, but it's not anything that's going to leave a mark. So that's not something you're going to see. One of the other things that we think about, Miriam Turk talked about the Flapa Shomrim. And that was an absolutely fabulous notice to the community. Be careful, watch your children. Go to the police if something's going on. It talked about stranger abuse. Statistically, most children are sexually abused by somebody they know and somebody they trust. So I can tell you, just the people that are being treated at the Borough Park office and Jewish Board, as well as in my private practice, not a single one of these children has been abused by someone they didn't know. They have been abused by an older boy, a bachur in yeshiva. They have been abused by their next door neighbor. They have been abused by their rebbe. They have abused by their camp counselor. All of these are people they know and trust. So it would be so lovely if it was the stranger, but it's not. It is actually the person they know. Some of the things we see in children when they were abused are very regressive behaviors. So one of the boys I'm treating, who is now, he was bar mitzvahed a few months ago, so he's 13 and a half. He was molested when he was 10. And his mother said to me this week, something is going on with him. He started bedwetting. He's not able to concentrate in school. And he's daydreaming all the time. He's angry. He's irritable. He's defiant. He's fighting. All of these behaviors let us know something else is going on. So when I said to him, what's going on? One of these deep questions that nobody can think of, right? So he says to me, I saw him. That's all it took. All he had to do was see the man who had molested him years ago, and he fell right back into all of those regressive behaviors. Because it was such an attack on his sense of self. And when you're in therapy, you make all these little baby steps. And we keep building on the baby steps. And then you see the abuser once, and then you go sliding back. Think of chutes and ladders. You get to climb up the ladder. I do play therapy, can you tell? You climb up the ladder, and then every once in a while, you hit one of those chutes, and you have to go sliding down to the bottom again. Every time a child sees the abuser, is told, ugh, it can't be true. Zadie wouldn't do something like that. I can't believe it. He didn't mean anything. She wouldn't do something like that. Every time someone says that to a child, they're sliding down that chute. They're not able to keep making that progress because they're being told it wasn't so terrible. Another one of those things we see is they're incredibly clingy to their parents because they don't want to go away from their parents. They want their parents to be there all the time to protect them. They want to be sure that nothing's going to happen to them, that there's going to be the adult who they told, who believed them, who's going to protect them. And all of a sudden, a child who used to be willing to go on play dates and used to be willing to go to sit in shul, they can't do that anymore because they're just feeling so unprotected and so unsafe that it's not something that they're able to manage. When we talk about off the derech children, I have a hard time with that. I just don't like that phrase. I don't like labeling people. But I'm going to talk about off the derech behaviors because those behaviors, for many of those children, are coping skills. When you are being abused, you do not want to be there. So one of the things lots of people do while they're being abused is they take themselves off somewhere else. So one of the women I abused said to me when she was a little girl and she was being sexually abused, she used to pretend that it was happening to someone else and that she was floating up above watching. When she was abused often and often, that became her way of coping. It worked during the abuse. The problem is when the abuse stops, if that's how you learn how to cope, that becomes a very unhealthy way to cope when things are going along fine. So lots of these children will be daydreaming all the time. They might be taking drugs or they might be drinking because it takes the pain away. You don't feel so terrible if that happens. They might be cutting. I don't know if you know what cutting is. I guess we'll get to that in a few years. But cutting is when children will say to us, when I cut myself and I see the blood, then at least I have a physical pain, so the emotional pain isn't so terrible. It's like the better of two horrible choices. We also see sexual acting out. They're just doing all of these things because they don't know how to deal with what happened to them. So they're finding another way to deal with it. Disordered eating. We have lots of people we see all the time, girls and boys, who are just vanishing before our eyes. They're not eating. They're playing with their food. They're moving it around. They're going to the bathroom and throwing up. They're using laxatives. When you don't feel good about yourself, that's another one of those ways that you try to take control of the life. Think about toddlers. There are so few things that they can take control over, or pre-toddlers actually, they can control if they're going to eat. They can throw the food on the floor, or they can put it in their mouth. So if you're suffering from abuse, you can also control what goes into your mouth, and you can punish yourself by not letting a lot of food in your mouth because you don't really think you deserve to eat and to feel good about yourself. Lying and stealing, they will do that because they're trying to get something to feel better, and they don't want whatever it is they took, usually, but they're taking something to fill up the hole that they have in themselves. The suffering that our children are going through, and I'm talking about the children because now, Baruch Hashem, you know, I heard the Rav talk about referring to a mental health professional. I heard Mr. Ganak talking about it. I said to Dr. Zakham, I said, we've come a long way. When we started this, we didn't talk about make sure you refer to a competent professional. And we didn't have as many competent professionals as we used to. I just know, and I can only speak about the Jewish Board Borough Park Clinic, but I know that my entire staff has just finished two trainings, one on cognitive behavioral therapy and one on trauma-focused therapy. We didn't have that 10 years ago. Now we're making sure that everyone is really skilled and competent and can help people. People who've been sexually abused, for good reason, have issues about being touched. Miriam has heard the story numerous times. I had a client I treated many years ago. And I treated three little girls. They were 6, 8, and 10. They were sisters. And their father had horribly abused their mother, and particularly abused the oldest girl, physically and sexually. So she came to me. She was the middle. No, she was the oldest. So she was 9 and a half or 10. And we decided, we were working for years, and for her, when she was 11, we decided for her bas mitzvah, maybe she would let me give her a kiss. Because she didn't let anyone touch her. When she started therapy, she was allowing her mother to kiss her, and she would fight with her sisters, because that's always okay. So gradually we increased that Bubby could kiss her, and then her aunts could kiss her. So she started at 9 and a half. When she became 12, I said to her, what do you think? She said, maybe when I'm a kala. Now, she knew me, and she trusted me for many, many years, not enough to let me touch her. So if you have someone where you want to go over and you want to put your arm around a little girl and she pulls away from you as if you're going to burn her, you have to wonder, why is this little girl so afraid of being touched? What is it that's getting her so nervous about it? The children who won't make eye contact with you, because the number one component of abuse is it's a huge secret. And they're afraid if they make eye contact with you, your Rebbetzin, you're going to know the truth. Somehow you will be able to figure out what they're thinking, what they're feeling, what they have went through, and then they're going to be in a lot of trouble. So they're not going to make eye contact with you. They might give you very short answers. Now, yeah, some people are shy and aren't comfortable talking to the Rebbetzin, but these children are also very afraid. So if you say, how are you, you'll get an okay, or Baruch Hashem, or I'm fine, and then they'll walk away. They don't want to engage in a discussion with you because they're just too afraid that you will find out what's going on. You'll figure out there's something wrong with them. The Rav spoke a little bit about addictions and pornography. That's as you get older. And if people don't get help when they're younger, they suffer for years. Mr. Ganak spoke about the Rebbetzins also being kala teachers. And that's another group that is really so smart. Because I have had a number of calls from kala teachers who said, I don't know, there's something with this kala. As soon as I talk about she has to go home with him, she gets really nervous. So picking up all of those signs and symptoms of what's going on, the sexual abuse is just permeates every sphere of life if it's not something that's addressed. We wanted to leave you with a skill. So the best way to prevent abuse is to talk and listen, not in that order. The more we listen to our children, the better off they are. We can listen to them, let them know that we want to hear anything they want to say. Nothing they say is horrible. Nothing they say is terrible. No question is outrageous. Because then they'll know that if something terrible happens, they have someone to talk to. And very often it's easier to talk to someone who is not their parent than it is to talk to their parent, especially since so much sexual abuse happens in the family. Now we're going to talk about the victims. And there are two categories of victims. There's one person in this whole scenario of sexual abuse who's not a victim, the perpetrator. He or she is not a victim. He or she might be an adult victim of something that happened in the past. So there are perpetrators. And just because someone was abused as a child does not mean they will guaranteed abuse people. It's important to know that. Because people who are sexually abused think, now they're doomed. That's not true. Many people who are sexually abused can grow up and lead wonderful, healthy adult lives. But there are some people who were abused who will then go on to abuse. But perpetrators are the only person in the whole scenario who need to take responsibility for their behavior. They have to acknowledge that they are the ones who did something wrong. It is never the victim's fault. I don't care what this person has done. Children can do a lot of outrageous things. Children don't ask to be sexually abused. So we have two categories of victims. We have the child who is being sexually abused or was sexually abused. We have his or her parents who I can't even imagine what it's like to find out that your child is sexually abused. The siblings of this child, because now the parents are anxious, the parents are nervous, the parents are worried. This brother or sister is fighting with them and making them crazy all the time. Without treatment, the future potential victims who might come down the road, and certainly the future spouse, who is going to have a hard time with this child when this man or woman gets married and has a hard time being in a healthy adult relationship. The other category are the perpetrator's family. The perpetrator has a wife or a husband. So now they find out that this is what their spouse has been doing for I don't know how many years. So he or she were treating a family. Her husband sexually abused many children. Imagine finding this out. This is, as she said to me when she first called, I lived with him. We have 7 children together. And now I find out this is what he was doing on the side. So he has a wife. He has 7 children. He has parents. He has siblings. I had a call last week. I rarely yell at people. But occasionally, I rise to the occasion. So a man called me last week, and he told me during the summer, his 12-year-old daughter told him that his 19-year-old brother molested them when they were spent Shabbos at his parents. So I said, what'd your wife say? I haven't told her yet. I said, so what did your brother say? I haven't spoken to him. He'll be much too upset about it. What did your parents say? Oh, they're in their 60s. I can't bother them. I said, have you gone back for Shabbos or Yontif? Yes. I said, how did you protect that daughter as well as your 8-year-old daughter and your 6-year-old daughter and your 4-year-old daughter and your sons? I told my daughter not to let my brother near her. He said, what should I do now? I didn't say what I wanted to say. I said, you need to speak to your wife. You need to speak to your brother. Here are the names of therapists who your brother needs to see. And then you can call me back. So I called Relief, who had made the referral, and I said, listen, this man is going to call because I wasn't nice to him. She said, oh, he called already. He told me you weren't nice to him. So I said, but he has to do something. I said, this 19-year-old brother of his, instead of letting him sleep in his house for Shabbos, he let him sleep in a sibling's house. So now we have all these other nieces and nephews who are in danger while this young man is being protected so he's not upset about it. The number of people that can be hurt if we don't help the perpetrator is, forget the dozens, it is just in the hundreds. My time is almost up. I like to end with a happy story. So remember the little girl I told you about who wouldn't let me kiss her when she was 12? So a year and a half ago, I got a call from her mother. I get updates, which is good. And she said, her daughter, Sakala, would I come to the Vort? So a lot of people don't invite me to things. You know, you know Faye Wilbur. What happened? So I said to her mother, did you tell Layla that you called me? Yes, she wants you to come. Okay. So I'm a wreck. I haven't seen this little girl since she was an angry 12-year-old. And I go straight from my office to the Vort. I went there early because I wanted to make sure I could talk to her for a few minutes. And the most wonderful thing in my professional career happened. I walked in and she went like this. So people can get better. We just have to make sure that we listen to them, that we talk to children, we tell them they have to be safe, and we have to make sure that they get the help they need and their parents get the help they need. Thank you for doing everything you do for Klal Yisrael all year.
Faye, thank you very much. You have made a very, very difficult topic not any easier, but you have made it a little bit more understandable. You have corrected some misinformation that is out there and corrected it to be proper information, and we are very, very grateful. Many of us in this room have been personally and professionally heartbroken by certain cases that have been mentioned here. I picked up the phone and called Reb Shmuel Kamenetsky last week, since he is our new, the task force, Mor D'Asra, and told him a little bit more about the task force, let him know that our Rebbetzin's conference was coming up, and I asked the Rosh Yeshiva if there was anything that he would like me to say in his name. I let him know that who's in the audience, I let him know that we tape it, and I was very careful with what he said. He emphatically wanted our audience to know very clearly that, and these were his words, molesters kill people for the rest of their lives. They need to be reported. The hows and ways they should be reported, we could talk about it another time. But again, I asked the Rosh Yeshiva if I could quote him, and he said, most definitely. And he said, and furthermore, he said, please tell the Rebbetzins a story. It's not a long story, it's about three sentences. After it became known that the Rosh Yeshiva was talking about molestation publicly and talking about it and how destructive it can be, he received a postcard from a 70-year-old woman who sent him a postcard to thank him on behalf of herself, being an abuse victim herself, and on behalf of the other molestation victims that he knew. She thanked the Rosh Yeshiva for coming out publicly, because coming out publicly validated the pain that they were in and validated the experience that she had been in. She then proceeded to say, I can now go back into the shul, where I guess some of the misfortune had happened, but I can now go back into the shul since the Rosh Yeshiva has validated me. With that, although it's a difficult topic, we're going on to another difficult topic, but we knew who to get for this topic. Dr. Norman Blumenthal, I've heard Dr. Blumenthal speak many, many times and often about very difficult, challenging topics. But he is always able to get us to laugh, to be able to intake the very, very vital information that he has to share with us in a way that is both useful and productive. Dr. Blumenthal is a licensed clinical psychologist in private practice in Cedarhurst in the Five Towns. He received his master's in 1976 and his doctorate from Adelphi in 81. He is the director of Bereavement and Crisis Intervention Services for High Lifeline, which is a task force member, and educational director of the Bella Harry Wexler Cohen Elyon and Smicha Honors Program at the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary of YU. He's the founder and chairman of the Board of Education of Kahal, a consultant to TOVA, a mentoring program for disenfranchised teens, and has guided us along the way through some very, very tricky paths. Dr. Blumenthal.
Thank you very much. I want to thank my mother for writing that introduction. I really actually have to be back in the High Lifeline office at 3 o'clock for I have a webcam presentation to London, so I'm a little rushed. And I'm actually going to change what I'm going to be doing today. I actually wanted to present on bereavement intervention with children. I don't think I literally have the time. So let me start by just doing introduce you to the program that we have, so you as Rebbetzins are familiar with this as a resource, okay? It goes back about 13 years ago. At that time, High Lifeline, as many of you know now, High Lifeline now deals with children with all sorts of illnesses, lo aleinu, but at that time, High Lifeline was specifically dealing with children with cancer. And I get a visit from Dr. Tony Cabot, who's the Director of Family and Children's Services. She has to come to my office. Life at that time was good. I had a busy private practice. I was doing some teaching. I wasn't looking to do anything else. That's usually when something falls on your lap. And she explained to me the following situation, which is, I think, somewhat relevant in terms of understanding bereavement. She said that while most children do recover from cancer, childhood cancer is not as scary a diagnosis as it is adult cancer, every once in a while, unfortunately, some children pass away. And the families, whom they knew quite well because they have been dealing with them for many years in the hospitals, were, of course, quite bereft. and they'd offer them referrals to therapists. They'd offer referrals to myself, Dr. Pelkovitz, whatever. And they consistently refused to take the referrals. And when they come, this is a very important point, and if I have another minute or two, maybe I can enlighten to you as to why. But they'd come to them and ask them, why aren't you taking a referral? And they'd look at them at the people and say, we're not crazy. Who wouldn't be upset? You know, they wouldn't need a referral. So she came up with the idea of having a weekend, a Shabbaton, for parents who lost children. And she asked me if I would anchor, if I would run that weekend. I have to admit that when she asked me, I was very flattered that Chai Lifeline asked me to do something so terribly important. I've subsequently found out that I was the seventh psychologist they asked. Nobody else wanted to tell. They finally said, well, who says no to nothing? Oh, Blumenthal, right. And then they came and they asked me. But I remember sitting in my office afterwards. It was probably during a session when I should have been listening to my client, but thinking to myself, you know, what do I need this for? Who wants to face this? And I'll get that's something else important, which I'll get to in a minute. And I was thinking about it, and then I said to myself, you know, if you're a mountain climber, you want to do Everest. This is Everest. And I accepted it. What did I do? So it happens to bereavement specialists. You know, Okay, great. So, of course, we started getting phone calls. Children died not only of cancer. We got calls for vehicular accidents, fires, murder, suicide. Unfortunately, we've dealt with it all. This mushroom, this grew into an entire department of Chai Lifeline, which I run, which is called Project Chai. And what we do is we work with, unfortunately, parents who've lost children. I mean, we are a child agency. So it's parents who lost children, young children who are orphaned from parents. And the other areas we deal in, which is even more recent as the department has grown and developed, is we do death notification, as we've been known more. Today we get the calls from Ms. Askim and Hatzalah when they're on their way to something happening. And we are sometimes the first ones to come down to the family, which is an art form. I've even met with the chief chaplain of New York City Police Department to compare notes in terms of death notification. It's a skill. It's not something you have to learn how to do. We do pre-bereavement or anticipatory grief, a very moving and difficult area where when there's an anticipated death, to orchestrate a goodbye, to bring the family together, and what kind of mindset they should have. When al pidera chateva, there will be a death, but on the other hand, you want to still have hope. A very recent area that we've begun to focus on, which is also very important, is to deal with sometimes the inadvertent perpetrator. Some of you may know that just recently in two Frum communities, there were situations where a Frum bus driver, in one case a neighbor of the victim, ran over a child. And that person is a victim. He didn't do it, and he's suffering. And the very well-known case in Williamsburg, which was written up recently, with the elevator shaft, to help the brother, who's the one who told his brother to jump down. So this is an area, that we're starting to focus on to develop our skills in this area. We've dealt a lot with, unfortunately, just like there's increased divorces and abuse in the community, there's an increase of suicide in the community. And we've dealt a lot with the issue of suicide, and I have to say that my colleague at work there, Rabbi Klar, some of you may know, has really made incredible inroads in the Hasidic community in helping them change their mindset in terms of this terrible tragedy. Another area, by the way, that we work with, and I think you should know this as Rebbetzins, is what's known as secondary trauma. In other words, we have to help the people who are the helpers. If you go down to a family, you have to notify them of a terrible death, you have to help them through that process, you are traumatized. And we spend a lot of time taking care of each other and even helping out some of the caseworkers in the other part of Chai Lifeline who spend their days on pediatric oncology units. If you yourself are in a situation where a tragedy occurs and you get involved, it'll have an impact on you. I've often quote the Medrash, the Shus of the Rav, the beautiful Medrash that says, when it says by Eliezer, says, Vasei chesed im Adoni Avraham. You should do chesed for my master Avraham. And the Medrash there says something very succinct, but it's really beautiful. He says, even Avraham Avinu, that brought chesed into the world, he needs chesed. So the doers of chesed need help as well. So those are the areas that we are available, and I think you should be aware. I think we're the only ones who are doing this. In fact, I don't get invited too much to parties or anything like that because I'm not exactly the most cheerful company, but we are. but we're available. We can be reached through Chai Lifeline, and if something of this sort happens, Baruch Hashem, you know, sometimes I say it's a blessing that we need bereavement specialists. There was a time when young children dying or parents, young parents dying was not so out of the ordinary. My grandfather, Lev HaShalom, was born in 1880. There were 11 children born in the family, only five of whom made it to an adulthood. Today it's rare, and therefore we need this kind of expertise. I'm going to conclude with one very interesting point, which I was not going to mention, but I think it just will bring home how much we sort of close our eyes to things. Do you know how the Eskimos have 100 words for snow? Right? Okay. There's a word in the English language for someone who loses a parent. They're called an orphan. There's a word in the English language for someone who loses a spouse. They're called a widow. You can go from the beginning of Webster till the end. There is no word in the English language for someone who loses a child. There is in Hebrew. Come on, Rebbetzins. Shachol, right. And in, that means a parent loses a child. And in modern Hebrew has adopted it. It's an av shakul and an em shakula. But you want to hear something else very interesting. Neither in English, nor in Biblical Hebrew, nor in Spanish, nor in French, nor in Arabic, and I've been checking it out, is there a word for someone who loses a sibling? Absolutely none. And it's a real avelis. It's a real loss. Modern Hebrew, I understand, in Israel now, they refer to it as an ach shakul and achot shakula. But it says something to the extent to which how much we de-emphasize sibling relationships and how much we don't focus on this tragedy, which does occur, of a parent losing a child. Just to end on a very beautiful note, Rav Shlomo Rafael Hirsch asked, where does this word shachol come from? And you know, Hirsch had a miyeka, a little chauvinism, but, right? But you know, where does, you know, he had a very good way of tracing the etymology of words. So he said the word comes from eshkol. He says a typical, eshkol, the grape. He said a typical plant is a dry twig, a flower, and then the fruit hangs. But the grape surrounds the dry twig. But if, God forbid, one of those grapes come off, or a few of those grapes come off, you're left with the dry twig. And that's where the word shachol comes from. Hopefully, God willing, that our grapes will always be completely enclosed, and we'll only have to deal with happy occasions. Thank you. I'm sorry, I got to run. Okay, but you know where to contact me. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you, Dr. Blumenthal. While we serve dessert, take a few minutes. There are index cards on your tables. Please think of any questions. We do have some time left. We can address some questions that you may have. Although some of our panel may have to be on the run, we have other mental health specialists in the room who might be able to join us to answer some questions.